that most first offers are not optimized. I typically say there's about 150 things to negotiate. Yeah, I guess first I'd say don't engage emotionally, and don't be thinking about, you know, what you're going to do once you sell your business yet. Hello and welcome to this week's Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from Revenue Rocket World headquarters in Bloomington, Minnesota. As you know, if you tune in regularly, or maybe if you don't, Revenue Rocket is the world premier M&A advisor to tech-enabled services companies. With me today is Ryan Barnett. Welcome, Ryan.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me. Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me. We were missing Matt, and that's why I just had to scream it out there. But I'm looking forward to talking to you today about a topic that is, I think, core to what we've seen the last few weeks and the last few months, which is, in this podcast, we always talk about issues that are impacting leaders of IT services firms. And one of the things we see is a huge uptick in people reaching out to them and for the purpose of being acquired. And so it's not uncommon for us to talk to a managed service provider that says, hey, you're the eighth person to talk to us this month. And I don't even know what to do because so many people, my phone is ringing off the hook on people, and I've just had to turn everyone away. And sometimes there's an offer that comes through that is probably worth taking a look at. And so what I wanted to talk about today was this, a little bit of a concept of what does it mean to engage in a quote unquote deal facilitation, where you're starting to talk to one-on-one with a potential suitor and what that might mean to your business across the whole market. So, Mike, I guess I'll just start it out with this general question is that, you know, we're seeing more founders come to us and saying, hey, I already have a buyer. And so, you know, what changed in the market that started bringing this in?
Well, there's certainly a lot of buyers, right? You know, some could argue it's a seller's market, continues to be a seller's market. Most of you that are out there running an IT services company know that you get lots of calls every week and sometimes every day from suitors that are looking to acquire your business. And not just suitors, but you've got proxies, M&A advisors, telemarketing firms, corporate development departments of private equity and strategics. All these guys are kind of fighting for your attention to say, hey, we'd love to buy your firm. They do a little bit of research on you and they say, this is right in our sweet spot. And sometimes not, maybe it's just a cold call and they don't really know. So there's certainly an increase in inbound interest out there. There's certainly more educated founders, right? Founders have access to more tools now to become more enlightened about how this process works. And they can move the process, I think, farther down the track. And, you know, I would also say buyers are reaching out earlier, in some cases, to develop a relationship over a period of years. So when a seller is ready to move forward, that they think of them. And, you know, I think there's this tendency where, you know, founders think that they're done before they start on a process like this, meaning they've got all this inbound interest. Maybe they engage with someone who's, you know, got your number or made a mention of, hey, we're looking to pay X multiple or this or that. They provide information and they get to a non-binding letter of intent at their number. And they think, oh, this is pretty much done. Now we can engage. Maybe we just think we can get it through or manage it through the process ourselves. Or they go, I think now we need to engage an advisor because most of the work is done. And they think that comes at a market savings from running what we call a full process.
Sure. So Mike, if it, in a scenario that I just heard you say, is that we've seen this, people get it, they receive interest, they go down a bit of a path and perhaps send over an unfiltered P&L or a balance sheet or do a little bit of work, some preliminary numbers, and a buyer comes back and says, here's a potential offer. Or, and to your point, they've already issued a letter of intent and really trying to move forward and likely with a no shop clause, get you out of you know, even thinking of going to market. So when someone says, "I already have an offer," what's your immediate reaction?
Well, my immediate reaction is from who, how qualified are they, what's the likelihood to close, have you already committed to a no shop, because of all kinds of things, right? And I think it's really important to know that most first offers are not optimized, meaning they are simply a number. And in some cases, they're not even real, because you have to remember that in a letter of intent, even not an indication of interest or IOI, but a letter of intent, you can say just about anything for an offer. The only binding provisions typically in a letter of intent are the no shop clause, which means that you can't go and continue to look for buyers while you're signed under this period of exclusivity in this LOI. The value is certainly not fortified, meaning it could be anything. I mean, a little bit facetious here, because generally, unless a buyer is a bad actor, they're, and we worked with some of those in representing sellers, frankly, they will honor what was in the letter of intent for the most part. They try to anyway. But it's not outside the realm of possibility that you have someone who's just telling what you want to hear, and then their plan is to come back and retrade or add structure or push some risk on you. You certainly miss, when you've done that, the competitive tension of running a process, which generally means you get better buyers with better prices, or and better terms, right? And so your desire to want to make it easy and low cost may be hurting you, frankly, in accepting that offer as written. And it's certainly, there's a lot that's not stated typically in a letter of intent that will come out in due diligence that can change that offer wildly from what's on the paper.
Sure. So if you're getting that offer and it's a first offer that you're seeing, why oftentimes is that offer just not necessarily the best offer that you could have?
Yeah, I think the lack of a competitive process certainly creates some issue, right? And what I mean by that is, when you have a lot of competition and that's being managed by an M&A advisor like Revenue Rocket, you get to choose between a variety of buyers, and usually a variety of price points and a variety of structures. And it's not just about price and terms. I think in a letter of intent, many times you're working through a more focused on price and terms than you are on the other components of what makes a real buyer effective. And that has to do with the strategic fit. There's a lot of aspects to what really aligns strategic fit and culture, right? Especially in private equity oriented firms or people that have professional corporate development, these are not ultimately people you're going to work with. You may be working alongside them, but you should know that their job is to go find companies to acquire and to manage that process from origination to close. And they're professionals at that. You're not. So, you lose leverage there. You do give the buyer advantage. And you have some issues as it relates to having this become sort of an anchoring effect situation. Founders make the mistake of interest for value when you're getting a lot of calls. And so they want to, in some ways, you have kind of happy years when that goes on and you get an offer and maybe you've negotiated it up a little bit, but you haven't fully optimized your financials. You haven't taken advantage of what third party negotiator could bring to the table. There's just a bunch of reasons why oftentimes a first offer is not the best offer. And you need to keep that in mind.
Sure. And I think we may talk out of both sides of our mouth. We do quite a bit of buy side work at the firm, so oftentimes when we're calling, it might be the best offer too. It is one of those things where your first offer, there is a chance that it could be the best offer. And in an M&A, it only takes one. But there is a little bit of caution here. But it also means that if you're evaluating that offer yourself, you really don't have context of what the market is there. And so if I think about it that way, Mike, what are some mistakes that founders make when you start to get a deal and when you start to take that offer that came to you and try to handle that deal over yourself?
Yeah, boy, there's a fair number of them, frankly, Ryan. I think certainly overvaluing their business is one, right? Thinking that their business, because it's their business, is worth more than generally it is in the market. That can be challenging. And sometimes you have buyers who know that going in and offer you that number, knowing they're going to retrade it. When they come back and look at, competitive sets and present that to you as, hey, here's where the last 10 deals that we know about traded, and you're asking for a multiple that's much higher. So, there's some, once they've locked you up at a no shop, as an example. Certainly underestimating structure. So, typically you can offer more if there's more risk put on the seller from a structure perspective. And there's a lot of ways to do that if you're a buyer. In earnouts, for example, if they're structured in a certain way, not to be fair and down the middle of the plate, but more tilted towards the buyer, that can set you up for failure to make those numbers. And there are certain things, certain common levers that a lot of buyers might pull to try to do that, right? And it's just trying to get the advantage in the negotiation. And you need to know what those things are. I think working capital is a huge one. Negotiating working capital happens in every deal. And there's certain standards that are set in the market. And you need a representative working for you that can do that effectively, and one that's knowledgeable and has done it many times to get, your working capital harvest out of the business. There's only one time you can really effectively harvest your excess working capital. And that's when you sell. And you need someone who's knowledgeable to help you there. If you don't, it's a common practice for buyers to land grab extra working capital or convince you that extra working capital needs to be in the business. And because you've been overcapitalized, likely over time, you are most likely to concede on this point. And really, it's not a fair ask on behalf of the buyer. It's just a way for them to reduce purchase price, for them keeping more working capital. Obviously, the details around, reps and warranties, you're going to have a lawyer who's going to help you there, but how you approach reps and warranties, how they're fortified, how the buyer protects their reps and warranty interest as you do, whether there's reps and warranty insurance or a holdback or an escrow or some, other mechanism like earnout or a seller note being used to fortify those reps and warrants are all things that can be negotiated. And frankly, it's a mistake that founders typically make if they try to negotiate this themselves. And certainly emotional decision making along the way, that this process is detailed. I typically say there's about 150 things to negotiate between LOI and close. Part of the challenge becomes how do you manage running the business with negotiating and leading the negotiation around those 150 things? It can be very disruptive to the business. And if it is disruptive to the business, as your business goes down in performance while you're away from it, the buyer will take advantage of retrading the deal towards the end of the negotiation when you're worn down, because it, the price, they'll argue, isn't warranted now because your business is shrinking. And so all those things become material mistakes that are made by founders if they try to roll their own deal. Not to mention the fact, I'll say one more thing, you know, statistics say that there's a pretty low probability, because of all these different things, that the deal actually gets done if you manage it yourself. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but you know, we touched on some of those here.
Right. Well, and if you mentioned you're starting to work through all of these issues from the structure and understanding the nuances there to terms and working capital, reps and warrants, you know, there's a lot for someone to deal with. And it sounds like help is needed from a variety of places. So if I was to ask, you know, when should a founder bring an advisor in if you already have a deal in motion?
Yeah, I would say earlier than you think. You know, if you're contemplating offers from outsiders and you've gotten it narrowed down to a short list, that would be a great time to bring in an advisor. At what I would call the latest point. And some founders just don't want to run a process because they don't want to go through the distraction, right? And it is a distraction. I don't want to sugarcoat it for you. So I understand that. So if they're looking at a couple offers, what they really need to do is bring someone in before the LOI, ideally. Now, even if they've negotiated an LOI on their own, and it's post-LOI, and they're going to accept that, and they say, yeah, I think we've covered everything, you need someone there that's going to help you facilitate getting that deal done. And it's really about protecting value and terms, not just price. Because the whole effort of diligence defense in itself is, you know, a practice area inside of our firm, and it is, and I think most advisors, you have to be able to have someone who can understand your numbers well and be able to defend them as you could to a potential buyer without that being a distraction, right? And, you know, you're going to want to have someone looking at your numbers and doing what I'll call pre-diligence to see if there's any issues in that in your financials that a buyer is going to, you know, dig into and challenge. Because when they start doing that, they're eroding value in the price. Because you have to remember that the number and the terms in an LOI are non-binding. And so until they dig in full diligence, they can't really get you to a number, price and terms that will be binding until they've done their due diligence and are now getting ready to draft the legally binding agreement. So the process of protecting the value and terms becomes super important. Not to mention that, but also there'll be a lot of ideation that comes during the LOI to close period around how to approach and deal with certain issues that come up, right? Might be a contract terminating or on your side, or some large client concentration issue, or could be any number of things. Could be some terms you have in a specific contract as it relates to transferability. There are things that come up that are very in the weeds details that you need someone with some experience to help you navigate.
Right. You know, you've outlined a ton of things of what a buyer is going to bring to the table. And if there is one buyer that does intrigue you and it makes sense, you've been able to establish some cultural fit and strategic fit, and perhaps you've aligned somewhat on the general terms of where a deal could happen. It's oftentimes it is great, I think, to engage an advisor. And to your point earlier, the earlier the better. Ideally, before an LOI is written, you're bringing in someone in. When we work with someone on kind of this one-to-one basis, we call this kind of deal facilitation. That's different than we have in a quote-unquote full process. Mike, can you just explain, you know, what is the difference? And let's just talk about that deal facilitation and how is that different from a full site process?
Yeah, sure thing, Ryan. So, you know, in short, it is, it takes less time and less scope to do deal facilitation. Now, it still includes some of the most valuable work that a advisor does. But in essence, if you think about a full sell side process, it's meeting the client, our client, at a point where they're thinking, yeah, I'm thinking about selling my business and I might want to run a process. Okay, so at that point, you've got to, get inside the client's head a little bit, understand what they're thinking about, what's important to them, get a valuation done, have them understand what that is, develop marketing materials, begin to do marketing and bring buyers to the table to qualify and ultimately get to a short list of buyers, which is very valuable because it creates competition and it helps move along to an optimized value, as we talked about before. But when you're doing deal facilitation, well, you're really meeting the client based on where their head is already at, meaning you've already talked to buyers, you've already got some sense of value, likely from competing offers, because the market's speaking as to your value. Maybe you've signed an LOI, so you've already made a commitment to a particular buyer. And you're like, okay, now what, right? So that means that we're not running a full process, and the scope and time involved from us is reduced to helping you get to close, right? So it's much more about helping you evaluate, negotiate, and structure an existing opportunity. And it comes with a lower price tag, frankly, because the scope is lower. So, do you benefit as a seller? Yeah, you might. I mean, from that perspective, you're going to save a few bucks. Is it the best path for you? Everybody's, has a different point in time where they need help and advice. And, I think certainly we want to meet you where you are at any point in this journey. And, we've had clients that were in the middle of deal facilitation. We determined the buyer wasn't correct and they wanted to go back to either another buyer they had talked to and that deal got done, or they wanted to run a full process. So we're not putting our thumb on the scale on whether it's better to run a full process or do deal facilitation. Really, I mean, we think certainly if you want the maximum number of options and the highest number and probably the best fit, running a full process is better. But if you've already done all that work yourself, we want to meet you where you are and we want to help get the, LOI to close process done effectively and efficiently and to optimize value.
Absolutely. I think that's really smart. And that's where a third-party advisor can really add a value is understanding, is this deal the right deal? And if it's not, here are the options for you. And sometimes facilitation does turn into full-sided processes. Sometimes facilitation leads to business improvement. And so I think there's definitely where if a suitor is reaching out to you and you have this one-on-one interaction, having a third person at the table to walk the, protect your interest and to help understand the full value of your business is critical. Mike, if you think about a lot of this, some founders, I think, they might feel like they're losing a bit of control if they hand over the process to an M&A advisor like us. How should founders kind of think about, quote unquote, control in this process? And where should their mental state be of bringing and engaging someone in when they've already had some interactions with a strategic suitor?
Yeah, it's an important question. Advisors don't take control. We never control that work. We add leverage, a lot of leverage to your discussion. And what's important about adding leverage is, it takes a village, if you will, to get a deal done. It takes your lawyer, and it takes typically a CPA or an accountant, tax advisor, and it takes someone to manage the negotiation with the buyer who's experienced, right? So it's about partnership. It's about just adding members to your team. And it's not about a replacement for you. You'll make all the final decisions, frankly, on how this process works, what decisions are made, and how to best navigate with that buyer. The key is you get leverage by using an experienced third party that you don't get on your own. And I think that's the most important point.
Yeah. So just last question I got for you here, Mike, and I'll let you wrap it up. But if a CEO was listening today and you just got an inbound offer, really, what's the first thing they should do before responding to that offer?
Yeah, I guess first I'd say don't engage emotionally, and don't be thinking about, what you're going to do once you sell your business yet, right? You need to really validate the buyer, around their credibility and certainty to close and their story. I think most sellers we know, we talk to and work with, want to make sure that their employees and their customers are well taken care of in a transaction. And you have to make sure that it aligns when you're talking to a buyer about their level of interest. What are they, what are they, what do you want? Do you want to sell in? Do you want to sell in? Do you want to sell out? Do you want to be around for a while or not be around for a while? Those are important considerations. And, I think understanding that offer and that buyer and the structure is important. And I think, bringing in perspective of a third party or an M&A advisor helps you do that, and it protects your optionality. And so what we'd encourage you to do is to call an M&A advisor and talk to them about what you're contemplating, whether it's us at Revenue Rocket or one of our peers in the market, and say, hey, I've got these offers. I've got people talking about this kind of offer, and I think it's interesting to me. And, what do you know about these guys? What do you know about buyers like this? What do you know about how you can help me? What do you know about, whether this is the right time for me or not? And a phone call can help you just formulate your thinking, and we sure do and welcome those conversations all the time. And so would love to have you guys give us a call, and we could share some perspective on if this offer is in the range of what would make sense for you if it's early on. Or if you've already signed that LOI and you're looking for a partner to help you, we'd welcome those calls as well.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having a great discussion here today, Mike. Really appreciate it. And I think that's some great advice. So I'll leave it to you to wrap it up.
Okay, with that, we'll tie a ribbon on it for this week's Shoot the Moon podcast. Look forward to you tuning in next time. We'll bring additional perspectives to your M&A thinking for if you're an IT services company. And with that, make it a great week.